content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. Hello, this is Jen Andrew for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be presenting the latest legal matters. Today's legal matters is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. This morning, I'll be talking to Alexandra Sutherland, housing attorney with Disability Rights North Carolina. Our topic today is housing and housing discrimination as it relates to people with disabilities. Research consistently shows that individuals with disabilities face higher rates of housing insecurity, including disability-based housing discrimination. So this morning, let's get to know you a little bit better, Alexandra. Can you start by telling us about your background?
Sure. I have been a practicing attorney for a little over 5 years now. Before I began to practice, I had to put in the time and focus and energy into becoming an attorney. So I attended Campbell University for undergrad and then Campbell Law School. I then started my legal career at Legal Aid of North Carolina, and after about 5 years or so, I transitioned to Disability Rights of North Carolina in 2023 as a fair housing attorney.
Excellent, and we're so happy you did. What brings you to this work?
For majority of my legal career, I worked in a wide variety of practice areas, including landlord and tenant law, also known as housing. In housing cases, I defended low-income persons against evictions and pursued other housing-related claims in small claims and district court. So I became very familiar with North Carolina's landlord-tenant law. However, when I learned that there was an opportunity to defend persons with disabilities by use of the Fair Housing Act, which is codified in federal and state law, I knew that disability rights was the place for me. Persons with disabilities is only one of the federally protected classes, and they are protected due to stigma and mistreatment that society tends to give to persons or certain groups that are by natural effect unique. So helping to uphold lawful standards is very important to me in this line of work.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. So I ask this question of all my guests. This work is challenging and can be difficult to witness the very real challenges and stigma, as you mentioned. So what is your why? What keeps you going?
I have always taken great pleasure and personal reward in defending the underrepresented from being bamboozled or severely affected by systemic bias. Any wrong that continuously permeates for years in our society creates a generational and lasting effect that unfortunately takes generations to also undo. So I made it my mission to always be an integral part of any solution to any problem, past, present, or future.
That's impressive. Thank you. We touched on before, you know, the nature of the work, the difficulty. What gives you hope in this landscape?
This might sound surprising, but it's actually the small successes that I take notice of. And they give me hope because they remind me that all things are possible.
I love that you said that. I was just, you know, articulating that sentiment to a coworker, saying, you know, taking away people's hope and the instance where folks might not have a vision to work towards, it's so discouraging. So on that note, why do you keep showing up for work, knowing all the challenges?
And the hard work that goes into it.
That's
so
right.
I absolutely love what I do. And the cliche is actually true. If you love what you do, then you will never work a day in your life. So I don't consider all that I do work because of my unwavering passion and dedication to whomever I serve. It's a feeling that it's something I have to do. And also, thanks to the many trailblazers before me, it is a great honor and a privilege to even be doing this type of work.
That's amazing, and we're so happy you are. So you've talked a little bit about your background and what brings you here. For our audience, can you kind of describe your role as a fair housing attorney?
Sure. I help to enforce the rights of persons with mental and or physical disabilities in the housing context. So the law says that historically disadvantaged groups, such as people with disabilities, have a right to equal housing and full enjoyment of their residence. My involvement could range from me educating or negotiating with a particular housing provider to providing in-court representation to a disabled person who may either be a defendant or a plaintiff. It all just depends on the posture of the case.
Makes sense. So what is the Fair Housing Act, and how does it help people with disabilities?
The Fair Housing Act is found in both federal and state law, but it was born out of federal law. And federal law, as we all know, applies to all states across the U.S. It protects particular minority groups, including disabled persons, from being discriminated or treated disadvantageously in housing. For example, covered housing providers cannot refuse to rent to a person with a disability, refuse to offer a loan for the purchase of a home, refuse to make any exceptions to a housing provider's rules upon a reasonable accommodation request, or refuse to allow a reasonable modification to the structure of a home or a common area on the property. Generally, if a person has a disability-related need and makes an accommodation request that has not been proven to be unreasonable, then a housing provider must grant the request, so that the disabled person can fully use and enjoy their residence like that of persons without disabilities.
That makes a lot of sense. For this particular audience, how could you, or how do you understand that your services specifically help those who are blind or low vision or hard of hearing?
Right. So, you know, these disabilities are obviously under our umbrella at Disability Rights, so there is absolutely no difference in the services that we provide to all disabled persons who meet the legal definition of disability. And again, so disabilities such as blindness or hard of hearing are well-recognized disabilities and are protected under the Fair Housing Act.
Thank you. Just for further clarification, who is supposed to follow the Fair Housing Act law?
Nearly all types of housing providers, both public and private, are subject to the Fair Housing Act. This includes housing providers such as property owners and their employees, so that might be a property management company, public housing authorities, real estate agencies, banks, homeowners associations, university housing, and developers, just to name a few.
So almost everybody.
Almost everyone.
Because I know you well, I know that you are very busy. And I'm assuming that that would indicate that, unfortunately, there's a great deal of housing discrimination.
Absolutely.
How often do you see housing discrimination against persons with disabilities?
Well, yes, the numbers don't lie. So the top source of housing discrimination complaints, both in North Carolina and nationwide, are those based on disability. So specifically, 60% of housing discrimination complaints, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, also known as HUD, that they receive involve disability-based discrimination. The majority of disability-based housing discrimination complaints stem from requests for reasonable accommodations or modifications. at Disability Rights, a majority of our intake calls are consistently from callers who feel that they are experiencing housing discrimination because of their disability. Disability-based housing discrimination has been a significant problem and may be getting worse due to our population's working group unexpectedly acquiring disabilities during the years that both they and society expects that they would be working to earn a sustainable living. The number of cases of mental and physical disabilities are rising at an alarming rate that many of us are willfully ignoring because we feel it is not our problem. If the current times do not show that collectively this is our problem, the not-so-distant future certainly will. There are numerous systematically orchestrated factors that have contributed and still contribute to disabling mental and physical impairments, either forming or worsening during the lifespan of an individual, with a greater impact, of course, on people of color. The facts are real, and the need for collective and combined efforts right now is at its greatest.
All excellent points. And I think sometimes what gets lost in the narrative about instances of disability is that most people over their lifespan will experience disability.
Absolutely.
So it really is something that impacts everyone. And as you say, numbers are rising. I think a recent statistic showed maybe 1 in 3 North Carolinians are living with a disability. So very timely topic. Thank you. Before you mentioned reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications, can you explain a little further what that means?
Sure. A reasonable accommodation is a change to a housing provider's rules, policies, practices, or procedures. A reasonable modification is a structural or physical change made to an occupied residence and to common and public use areas. However, both a reasonable accommodation and a modification are requested by a person with a disability so that, again, that they may be able to use the home the same as their non-disabled peers.
Thank you. So just to kind of let our audience know, how would a disabled person make a request for a reasonable accommodation or a reasonable modification?
To make a reasonable accommodation or modification request is fairly straightforward if the best steps are taken throughout the entire process. So first and foremost, the request should be made in writing so that there is a written trail to follow. Without a writing, it is hard to show that a request was ever made or approved. Secondly, the person with a disability can make the request on their own. However, generally, anyone with personal knowledge of a person's disability can make the written request on their behalf. Third, this is a very important step here, the request must state with specificity the accommodation or modification that is needed, and it must clearly state a disability-related need for the accommodation or modification. If a disability-related need is not clearly stated, then it usually leads to a denial or a delay in the interactive process between the requester and the housing provider. So the next question might be, well, how does one clearly state a disability-related need? Well, typically, a medical or mental health professional can verify and articulate the disability-related need for the accommodation or modification, and should do so by a written letter of support. The fourth point is the requester should then submit his or her request and supporting documentation to their housing provider. It is recommended that the requester give the housing provider at least 10 business days to respond to the request in writing as to whether they will grant or deny the request. And that's the general process in a nutshell.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense, and it sounds like, you know, making sure you've got some medical documentation before you even begin the process, because we all know how long it can sometimes take to get in and see somebody. That's great information. So we all hope this wouldn't happen, but what if a housing provider did not grant a reasonable accommodation or reasonable modification? Or worse, attempts to evict a disabled person, what would be the next steps?
So there is recourse for when a reasonable accommodation or modification is not granted, or if the housing provider tries to evict a disabled person because they made the request. The requester can file a fair housing complaint with the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. Again, that's HUD. Or they could also go through the local agencies of HUD called the Human Relations Commissions, or HRC for short. The individual would be working with these entities and go through their internal processes of pursuing fair housing complaints. In an eviction case, there is already an open court case. So the disabled person may bring a fair housing defense and or counterclaim against the housing provider in the case. A case could be resolved by settlement without the need for a trial, but sometimes, in my experience, a case would need to be heard or, you know, and decided by the presiding judge.
Do you, in your experience, do most housing providers, are they aware of their obligations? As far as you can tell, I know that's hard.
Right. It is. Honestly, it's hard to gauge it, but I would say it's about even, where some housing providers are not aware of the Fair Housing Act. And to be honest, I was unaware of the Fair Housing Act after, you know, doing so much landlord-tenant work. I was like, wow, this is a thing, like, you know, and it's so particularized, right? So that's understandable. And then usually education helps them to do the right thing. Other times, housing providers are aware and they'd rather just ignore or push the boundary on how that law will be applied to their particular situation with their tenant.
Makes sense. So if you are a housing provider, we hope you're paying particular attention to some of these points. So what type of in-court representation do you provide to disabled persons facing housing discrimination?
Typically, we provide representation to a person with a disability where a housing provider has initiated lawsuit by an eviction complaint to remove the person from the home. So we come to the defense in these types of cases to prevent an unlawful eviction. Most of my representation takes place in state court because that is where many cases start and are resolved one way or another. We can also provide representation to disabled persons by filing a complaint in federal court if there appears to be a violation of the Fair Housing Act by the housing provider. However, it is important to note that when a complaint is initiated by a disabled person, it places them with the burden of proof to show discrimination, and the housing provider is on defense. However, in any of the situations I described above, disability rights is only able to provide representation if there is a disability-related connection to the eviction or the basis for the discrimination. And so we have to decide whether we are able to provide representation on a case-by-case basis.
That makes sense. So I think I hear what you're saying is that there may be instances of discrimination that might not relate to disability.
That's
and that
correct.
Would be out of the scope of our work.
Absolutely.
That makes sense. So what type of out-of-court representation do you provide?
A large portion of our work takes place outside of court. And this is because the primary goal is usually to avoid the filing of an eviction or the filing of a complaint. We have to remember that litigation, although might be fun, might be victorious, it's not a quick process, and it also may not offer a just remedy. So generally, litigation takes time, money, and a lot of energy from all the parties involved. We try to get involved early on, if possible, in the effort to settle issues without the need of our clients spending too much time and exhaustive energy that they may not even have into a case that may ultimately not work out in their favor by a court order. Some of our out-of-court involvement might include me drafting a reasonable accommodation or modification request, writing a letter to the housing provider detailing the rights of our clients, negotiating with the housing provider, and even attending administrative hearings in subsidized or affordable housing cases. And to just kind of expound on what that administrative hearing process is, it's different from going through the civil courts. It allows parties to work out their issues before a case is filed in civil court, where the rules of evidence and a lot of other things come at play. And so usually we try to step in at that point to go, you know, to prevent going further than that.
That makes sense. And I like that you spoke to, you know, the time, money, and energy, because we all know that folks who are living with disability, you know, those are already in short supply. Mm-hmm. Living with a disability is pretty tough in our society. Right. So I thank you for naming that. What does it mean for a disabled person to self-advocate? You talked a lot about maybe trying to avoid, you know, some of these energy draining activity. So maybe there's some like a first step that involves self-advocacy.
Oh, yes. So to self-advocate, we might define that as meaning that one understands their rights and employs the courage needed to exercise those rights by their own efforts. We encourage self-advocacy where possible. We encourage self-advocacy wherever possible because we understand that every person who needs legal help cannot be served by the services of an attorney. However, we do our best to provide the guidance and basic information and knowledge to the public so that self-advocacy can be made possible for them.
That's a great point. It sounds like, you know, really educating folks is a great first step. Do you provide trainings on the Fair Housing Act to the public?
Yes, because we understand the importance of community education to help those in need of basic knowledge about their rights. We are in the process of scheduling in-person trainings, virtual trainings, and releasing video trainings that we'll post to our website and social media. And we're also available for trainings upon request.
That makes sense. Are there any, like, the most important things that maybe you'd want somebody who is getting ready to rent or purchase a home to know before entering that situation?
Always make sure you read the paperwork, and if you can't understand it, please include someone that you trust to read your lease, to read your rental contract purchase, to read the HOA covenants that might be there. So again, understanding documentation before you sign is critical. And also, if you know you're going to need a reasonable accommodation or modification, go and ask for that up front. You know, there's no reason to wait until you get in. You know, let the housing provider know what you need, why you need it, and like we talked about before, just making sure you get all the documentation needed to verify and support that request.
Would you have any materials that might help a disabled person advocate for themselves?
Yes. At Disability Rights, we have tons of materials on our website. and so there's written guidance there. There's templates. There's sample letters for the requester, for the treating physician, that provides the education and encouragement to all those involved with someone trying to make a request. And so we, of course, see that most of the time that our materials are typically used when there is a need to make a written reasonable accommodation and modification request.
How could a person with disability who feels they've been discriminated against by their housing provider apply for services?
If you are a person with a disability and you feel that you have been discriminated by your housing provider because of your disability, you may call our intake line at 919-856-2195, or the faster route would be to apply online at www.disabilityrightsnc.org.
Thank you. I also was curious, I know you probably can't provide details, but is there a recent case maybe that sticks out in your mind that feels like a big win or maybe felt encouraging?
Yes, there is one. This was a case involving the Public Housing Authority, and this particular person needed a reasonable accommodation for a live-in aide. And for years, it was known, but the Housing Authority did not give it much attention until we got involved. And so once that took place, we were able to have a formal hearing, and we were able to get our client a live-in aide, and also his voucher was reinstated because that had ceased in this process as well. And so we're waiting for subsidy payments to be paid to the housing provider that missed out, and we're waiting for, you know, everything to kind of check out and we can all move forward happily.
Excellent. So I will close by asking, if I gave you a magic wand and you could change one thing about our system as it is now, what do you think that one thing would be?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. You know, I would change that. I think more transparency. I think sometimes we see folks make certain decisions and we assume that they made the decision a certain way, but if people were just more honest and open about why they did something, maybe conversations might go a little better and people might be a little bit more understanding on both sides. That might be it.
That sounds like sage advice for everyone.
Yes, right.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Alexandra, for talking to us today. Our listeners, I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Legal Matters. Again, I'm Jen Andrew, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Thank you for tuning in, and so long until next time.